This episode of Life and Books and Everything is brought to you by Crossway, publisher of O Sacred Head Now Wounded, a liturgy for daily worship from Pascha to Pentecost. This is written by Jonathan Gibson. Johnny presents a 40-day devotional liturgy to help readers effectively prepare their hearts from Pascha, that is Easter, to Pentecost. You may have seen or used some of the other volumes in this same series, the Be Thou My Vision, which many of us have used and benefited from, which pulls together, I think of it as sort of a reformed version of the Book of Common Prayer, and it goes through with a daily liturgy for you in family worship or in your own private worship, some readings, some prayers, some scripture, some creedal material, and this is the same format, but specifically for that season from Easter to Pentecost. It helps individuals and families establish a posture of remembrance and gratitude as they focus on what Christ has done through his temptations, life, trial, passion, death, burial, resurrection, ascension, and Pentecost. So pick up a copy wherever books are sold, or visit crossway.org/Easter Liturgy. Learn how you can get 30% off with a free Crossway Plus account. We also want to thank our friends at Desiring God for supporting the podcast, as we are now many weeks into the new year. You may look back at your New Year's resolutions or some of your goals and already finding hard to keep up with them. And DG wants to help us try to make good on some of those aims. Every Good Resolve. This is a new video series with David Mathis on building habits that feed your faith. Really is important to build habits as Christians, and yet there's a way to do it that is life-giving and empowered by the Spirit, and then a way that is just soul-crushing and feels legalistic. And David Mathis knows how to teach on this. He's written on it. He's a good guide as you think about how to follow through with goals and develop habits that enable you to pursue joy and produce life-changing godly character. You will be given practical and biblical tips on how to form these life-giving habits. You can join DG for Every Good Resolve. Go to desiringgod.org/resolve. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. I'm Kevin DeYoung, the senior pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, North Carolina, right next to Charlotte. I also teach at Reformed Theological Seminary. And one of my intellectual avocations, I guess, far from an expert in all these topics, but I do love American history. I love the American founding. I love 18th century. Some of my doctoral work certainly overlapped with that. And so I am really, I am all in on the 250th anniversary of reading as many things as I can. So I'm really excited for a special guest today on LBE, and that is Dr. Matthew Spaulding, PhD in government from Claremont, a professor of constitutional government at Hillsdale in their DC campus, dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government, and vice president for their Washington operation. So, Dr. Spaulding, thank you for being on the program and for talking about your new book, The Making of the American Mind, The Story of Our Declaration of Independence.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to talking with you about it. I'm excited about it as well. And America 250, and I'm hoping to make a major contribution to that. So,
yeah, are you? I had Wilford McClay on a few years ago when the 250 was just in the distance, and he said he was part of some planning groups, which I was glad to have somebody like him. Is the president or other people, are you on task force that's doing things for 250?
Very, very much so. We're doing kind of different things. So, Bill McClay, who's a faculty member, is right on the He's actually on the Congressional Commission, which is kind of the official Congressional America 250 program. I'm working very closely with there's a White House task force and something called Freedom 250, not, you know, is a different organ. And they're doing things that are actually doing a lot of the major commemorations and events. So, for instance, you might recall that the on New Year's Eve and then a few days afterwards, that there is a projection onto the Washington Monument. Freedom 250 in the White House Task Force is the one that did that.
Okay.
I'm actually a senior advisor for that task force.
So that makes me feel good. We're going to get this right. We're not going to.
It's going to be a lot better than it might have been otherwise. Let's put it that way. But also, I mean, you know, one of the major problems here is that this had been neglected for a long time. I mean, the Congressional Commission, for instance, has been around since the Obama administration and really has not really done much. So we're kind of behind, and that's a concern. Although what I find most really heartening is the extent to which a lot of Americans who are kind of coming out of the woodwork wanting to celebrate this event, wanting to relearn about American history and really for the right reasons, wanting to rediscover it in some substantive way. So I think that, will everything be perfect? Will it be as big? I think it'll be very big, that mm-hmm. for sure. Will it hit all the marks? I don't know. It's probably too soon to tell, I suppose.
But it'll hit some.
But it'll hit the major ones. It'll hit the big ones. But I'm getting a sense there's the timing right now in our culture and the deeper debates going on, the shifts, if you will, about both in terms of, young men searching around for some sort of moral guidance, but also more people wanting to go back to church in the kind of post-COVID world and looking for meaning. This is almost a providential coincidence that America 250 is happening right at the moment when our country needs this kind of conversation. So, and that's really the aspect of the debate I most wanted to contribute to. I love history. History is what my background is. This is a book. This is a work of history. But if you've looked at it, you know very well that it's really meant to use that history to draw the reader into the narrative, and then in that narrative get a more of a sense of a transcendence in the Declaration.
That's right.
That points then towards eternal questions. I don't know if you noticed, but the book, I think in the prologue or the introduction, I can't remember which one now, it actually, the opening quote is from C.S. Lewis and his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, which is about his conversion to Christianity. But in that book, this is what struck me in one of the kind of underlying themes of the book that I don't talk about as overtly, but it's clearly there, is C.S. Lewis talks about how when he was studying history, by which he meant pagan old mythologies, that history as an Oxford professor, that's what actually began his turn towards discovering the eternal questions that drove him towards Christianity. And so my attempt here is to have us see the history of the Declaration and these permanent truths. I mean, I think there's actually more substance to the Declaration that is widely recognized, including theological substance, which we can talk about. My view is that the Declaration actually has that same effect, which is it surprises you the extent to which once you get into it, it'll draw you towards things. And it might, as with C.S. Lewis, be surprised by joy in the sense that it draws you towards eternal questions. That's part of my objective here.
No, that's a great entree. And I did notice, you know, and we're going to talk about this a lot because I'm a pastor. That's my heartbeat. I'm a Reformed, Orthodox, Evangelical, Presbyterian pastor. I love America. I love being an American. I belong to a heavenly city that's more important than this American city. And I mean, you have a whole section toward the end on the theology, and you use that word explicitly, the theology of the Declaration. You're very clear. I mean, this is, in one way, it's not a Christian treatise, and in the other sense, it's inescapably a document that's infused with all sorts of Christian terms and principles and ideas.
That's right. No, I think if we think about the history of the of these ideas, if you will, I mean, to some extent, this is a debate. This is a discussion about America, and the Declaration is really the central act of this great drama called the American Founding. And so these questions are central. Does the Declaration talk about permanent things? I mean, it talks about we hold these truths, for instance. It doesn't say we have some values. It's about claims of that man is metaphysically capable of understanding and grasping reality. And so I'm really beginning coming into it from a very different angle. I'm trying to capture what were they thinking? Where does this come from? You know, Jefferson, the title of the book comes from a letter Jefferson wrote where he said, I wasn't intending to invent new ideas here. I wasn't making things up. This is not just me. I was writing out what I understood to be an expression of the American mind. Well, that broadens the conversation. It's not just a conversation about Jefferson. Jefferson, as you well know, is rather quirky, especially when it comes to Christianity. But that shouldn't cause us to not see what's going on here. That historically, the Declaration is always seen, and that's always then applied on the founding, is that they're a bunch of deists, and all they're interested in at most was kind of a rational deism. And I just think that's profoundly wrong. If you simply look at the history of the document and the debates around it. And so I came to the conclusion, and there's plenty there. This is not something that kind of comes out of nowhere, but I really spent a lot of time deeply thinking this through, that actually there's a theology of the Declaration, and it was put there initially by Jefferson, who made some of the references, but then the Continental Congress itself amended the document, and it goes through these debates. And it's worked on by all the members. The committee amends it, and they come up with this document. And if you read it honestly on its face, it is not a kind of secular rationalist document at all. I think that's a complete misread because, among other things, I don't think there were a few like Franklin or Thomas Paine had very odd, if not deistic views. But even Jefferson was very respectful of Christianity, even though he was quirky and didn't actually believe Christ was the Son of God. But he was still very respectful of it in a way that he knew he couldn't get away with some crazy idea if he wanted to do that. I mean, look, Witherspoon was the chaplain of the convention, or it wasn't going to happen.
And Roger Sherman, I mean, very devout.
Yeah, well, John Hancock, the head of the Constitutional Congress, was a devout Congregationalist. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen. So, if you then look at it seriously that way, because we can overread this, and I think it's sometimes we in our wanting to read more into it, overread it. But if you look at it honestly and just kind of walk through the Declaration, there's a lot there. And, you know, so the overarching point, one of the overarching points I like to make is that there are only two individuals in the whole Declaration. And one of them, this might be a spoiler alert, one of them is the King of England, and he's the bad guy. The other one is not. But both these individuals are all powerful, and one is a tyrant, and the other one is not. Which is to say that God is the other dominant figure in the Declaration. And God appears five times, the laws of nature and nature's God, at the very beginning, which is a moral grounding, if you will, a touchstone. And we can talk about that at length, because I actually think that phrase is extremely important. And has biblical grounding, not kind of deistic, rationalistic grounding. The laws of nature and nature's God. And then it turns out, we skip these words all the time. We've read it so many times. We hold these truths be self-evident, what? That all men are created equal. Oh, well, that's not just merely a random word, created equal. And then it turns out very after that, it repeats itself, which is very rare. And they are endowed by their creator. In a short document, you rarely repeat words. Creators twice. And then towards the end, God appears a fourth and fifth time as the supreme judge of the world, who sees into our hearts the rectitude of our intentions. And then at the end, the signers themselves, when they essentially pledge to each other their lives, their liberties, and their sacred honor, they do so in the name of divine providence, which is to say that this God actually does intervene in human affairs. So just on its face, this is not a deistic watchmaker God. And actually, if you look at the movement of the Declaration, and again, go back and read it yourself. You know, we've just read through it carefully and slowly, right? At the beginning, it's a God that we really don't know. We know through our reason and natural law and you know, the God who creates nature. Mm-hmm. But then it turns out this God created man. specifically. And not only did God create man, which say this is not a pantheistic world, this is a creator God who intentionally creates the human being. He endows that particular creation, not the dolphins and the birdies, but he endows man with these unalienable rights. And then it turns out towards the end that God can see in the hearts of those individual men and judge them, and that those men can pledge themselves to each other based on a sense of divine providence, which is to say this God does intervene in human affairs if he so chooses under the right circumstances. So
there's a lot of God language.
There's a lot in there. So on the one hand, it's not it kind of says too much if we put too much of a heavy emphasis on specific like doctrinal biblical New Testament language, right? It's not specifically Presbyterian or Congregationalist or whatever it might be. That would have been problematic because of the various history of religious wars and whatnot. They wanted to get away from that, but instead they took the ground that we're going to take the it's not the lowest common denominator of mere rationalism. I think that's incorrect, but it is the common denominator in the sense that what do we all believe in? And essentially, for lack of a better term, it's essentially the Old Testament idea of God, right? A creator God who actually watches over man, who intervenes sometimes in human affairs, who knows us, but you can't get away from the influence. There's a clear Christian influence there. God created us. He knows us. It's just very profound, I think.
And you remind us, and I love this as a Presbyterian, that those four designations for God are all found in the Westminster Confession.
Exactly, which I point out in the book. Yeah. To say, you know, this deistic language, well, that's actually the language of the time in the great writings of the time.
Yeah, it's not the Apostles' Creed. It's not the Nicene Creed. It's not the Westminster Confession. It's not the 39 Articles. But it's not mutually exclusive to any of those things either. And it is using judge, providence, nature and nature's God creator. These are common 18th century ways. Yes, they're non-sectarian. They're, you know, I would not be ordained as a Presbyterian minister with that thin of a theology. But then again, that's asking them to do something that they weren't setting out to do. And we ought to have eyes to see all that they really did do in a document like this. Is there, I mean, I don't expect an expertise in every other country in the world. I'm trying to think, you know, there's the Magna Carta, of course, and there's other countries have, you know, key documents. But is there anything like this in the founding of a country that as much as America, I mean, we go back to this over and over. You know, there's a, you know, a famous book called Sacred Scripture about the Declaration. And it almost functions that way. Of course, it's not inerrant. It's not from the hand of God in the same way. And yet, is this unique to America to look at a founding document quite so powerfully?
I think it is actually unique. So here, let's you know, back up and speak very broadly for a moment, because I think this is actually the dynamic going on here that we have to understand. And again, I think we've oftentimes misread that, which is the history of the founding of the colonies is largely of different religious groups coming over from Europe, escaping various forms of persecution. And they come over here, and you can actually track the founding of the colonies based on what was going on in Europe as they came over to establish their own colonies. The question of religious liberty is a fundamental aspect of the American experience. So what we don't have here is we don't have the, which is more traditional in a European, a document or beginnings. We don't have a specifically Christian or specifically sectarian beginning. But their experience, the immediate experience leading up to the American founding, was that has caused problems and causes religious strife, including religious warfare. We want to avoid that. But the problem that is generally made when this is taught in the classroom is that they went to the opposite extreme, which is religion is dangerous. We must expunge it from our politics. And I think that's just incorrect. There's really hard to find something there that establishes that mm-hmm. fact. But they did mean to make it non-sectarian, non-specific, general. And so you'll get plenty of things we can point to, which does tip its hat to the Christian tradition, broadly understood. But it also true there, and there's plenty of evidence of this. They wished to be open to their Jewish brethren. There was increased toleration to other forms of Christianity, whether it was more specifically Puritan or more, say, Catholic. All that is true. But the assumption here is, and we shouldn't make the assumption that the only way to get there is to be so completely watered down that it's completely meaningless. And that's not what they were doing. They were trying to say, is there a moral ground, mm-hmm. a moral, intellectual, defensible ground upon which we can base politics? We're lowering politics. That does not at all mean we are lowering the ends of man in his highest sense, which is why we're defending religious liberty in the first place. And I think if you read it that way, the Declaration is clearly written in that sense. They're trying to find that ground. And so what I was going to say at the end of your last question there, so on the one hand, if you're looking for a thicker doctrinal basis, right? Yes, it's not there. I will be the first to admit.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the intention. But it wasn't intention to erase everything. But what is there, I think, is what we might call the beginnings of faith. Mm-hmm. And you find in the tradition, kind of the older tradition, the medieval tradition, even in Hooker, I like to teach Hooker a lot, is this notion that the beginnings, you can have something that isn't quite fully religious. It doesn't kind of go to those doctrinal issues, those doctrinal questions, but it does lay the groundwork, if you will, for getting there. And I think that's what they were doing. There's not a sense of wanting to expunge religion. They didn't want to take sides in those battles. They didn't want to bring the wars of Europe over to America, but they wanted to have a substantive, serious ground for their politics. And I think they ground it in the Greek and Roman thought was very influential. Cicero, I think, was very important. Mm-hmm. Old British tradition, the common law, all of that was very important. But it was really the Christian tradition going back from the beginning. I mean, you know, broadly speaking, you wouldn't have the founding if you didn't have Christianity.
Right. Yeah. The natural law tradition, of course, there's Greek and Roman roots there, but there are not only Aquinas and medieval roots, but Reformed theology embraces many aspects of natural theology. That whole tradition is foundational to what the Declaration is saying. And I remember reading, somebody did statistical analysis of revolutionary era pamphlets, not even sermons, but just published material.
Right.
And by a wide margin, the Bible is the most cited document. They're not even looking at Christian.
Right. I actually know that study. It was by Heinemann and Lutz were the guy's name.
Yes. Yeah.
And they went through all the documents and there are two things they found there, which I found fascinating. One is overwhelmingly the most references are to the Bible. That's phenomenal. Just by itself. But the other thing I found fascinating, which I know in the book is, because we kind of go back to this question about John Locke. How important is John Locke and what does that mean? And we can address that more if you'd like to.
Yeah, I'd love your take. I've read both sides of that.
Yeah, I think Locke is very important, but it, in many ways asks the wrong question. There are philosophical aspects of Locke that are problematic. But the Americans weren't Lockean in the full philosophical sense. They read the Locke they understood, the two treatises, but they also read Locke through the Christian tradition. So they read the Christian Locke, the Locke of religious toleration. But the point is that they saw themselves in that tradition, as they kind of created this document. So this notion of nature, natural law, is a natural rights, is a modern idea in many ways, but in the other, if you look at it more broadly, it's a very old argument that goes back to the beginning. And it and really, the bridge back to all those old ideas is the Christian tradition. I mean, Hooker was very influential. The Reformed Church was very influential. The point I was going to make about Locke, what I brought in the first place, is the largest number of references to Locke in the founding era are found in sermons.
Hmm.
That I find very striking.
And not his philosophy of the mind, which is your point, but
right. No, exactly. The treatise of the references to his writings on Christianity.
Yeah, yeah, and its toleration. And I wonder, I'm jumping around a little bit, but one of the things I hadn't seen before, and this is such a good book, I really commend it to our listeners, The Making of the American Mind. I'm talking to Matthew Spaulding, because we need a book like this. I mean, it's obviously, you know your stuff, you teach this, and you have all the smart footnotes, but it's a book that somebody could just pick up and read. You don't have to be a doctoral student in the American founding. You walk through to give enough background and history of where are some of the ideas, who are some of the main thinkers, just line by line. It's very easy to follow. But what I was saying, one of the things I hadn't seen before, you make this distinction about how they talk about their British brethren. They use that language. And then how they talk about one people, what makes a people. Right. And it seems like there's a lot of potential payoff here on how we even think about the founding of America and current debates about, are we a creedal nation?
Right.
Should we be looking at the blood and soil kind of nationalism of Europe? Talk about that insight, because I hadn't pieced that together as you did.
A crucially important piece. You know, so many of the debates today, that one in particular, other ones, you know, is this a Christian nation? There actually are pretty good arguments to be found in these documents if we look through them again in a way perhaps we've forgotten about. But on this one in particular, I think it's very important, because I think there actually is an answer to that question. Because the Declaration in particular, but the Americans in general, break from the older notion of what it meant to be a group, if you will. I'm carefully choosing my words. What drew me to that in the Declaration is a reference to our British brethren. Indeed, if you look at the Declaration and other documents of the Continental Congress, the British are always referred to as our brethren. The Americans refer to themselves as a people. Mm-hmm. How can they understand themselves to be something different from the British? Well, the British were our brethren since we were related to them. In the straightforward common sense, they are our ancestors, our parents, our uncles, and they will remain our brethren. Enemies in war, in peace, friends. But they aren't a people. We are a people, and we have become a people because of our common sufferings, the strife we've lived through, but most importantly, because we have come to agree on how things, what are the core principles around which we should operate. So there is a very specific or a very important distinction in the Americans about what it means to be a people that doesn't really pre-exist. The old notion, the old European notion, right, is blood and soil, ethnicity, race. If you were born in Germany, you can be a German. Mm-hmm. But you can never become an ethnic German. America is different. There is this creedal aspect to America, but we can overstate that as well. It's always understood that we are a particular people in a particular place, a political set of circumstances, a particular history. And yet they came together at this moment based on all these intellectual influences, these cultural influences, and they came together on this set of ideas around which we are going to define our nation, our regime, our way of life. And that's what they mean by a people. That's what makes a people a people. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that at one point in the Declaration, it says the British are deaf to that problem. As they literally are deaf. Why? Because they aren't a people, they are subjects. They understand themselves as subjects of a monarch. And that's the key distinction. We, on the other hand, are self-governing. we have our own communities, our towns, our own families. We're going to govern ourselves. We rule ourselves. We legislate. We're fighting for our rights as individuals.
And of course, that's the language later in the Constitution. Absolutely. Starts, we the people.
And the British, they just don't understand that. Their notion is not to be a people. So the extent to which we refer to the British as a people is in the same way we refer to the Irish people. It's just an ethnic thing, or the German mm-hmm. peoples. But the notion of political notion of people that develops in America is just not seen in that in those other countries.
As you talk about this, and I'm sure you're going to be talking about it for these next months, and as the book is now out, probably the people who want to come and hear this are they already like the Declaration. They want to know more about it. And you've taught this for many years. But as you talk to people and read and kind of know what's out there, what are the sort of objections that people have? Why would people not like the Declaration? Because it comes from all sorts of different angles now of people that might not like the Declaration. What are some of the objections you hear? You're talking about one of them, maybe they don't like the religious elements, but usually people don't say it that way. They just say, well, they're not there.
Right, right.
What are the other sorts of arguments you hear when people don't like it?
The general source of criticisms is, I would put in the category of what we call presentism, which is we look backwards to find things to make our argument. Mm. So, for instance, modern secularists who want to argue a certain thing about America today look back and use the Declaration to make their argument, and they look around and find what they can use by make useful. The same thing is true for the question of slavery. I very much like to teach American history in the question of slavery. Very straightforward, warts and all. I throw a lot of my interviews off because I like to talk about the question of slavery. But I don't necessarily, that doesn't lead me to conclude that America is systemically racist or a problem from the beginning. These are hard, difficult political problems. But the motivation today is to want to fight a debate currently about race mm-hmm. in America. Therefore, we look backwards in history to use it to find things we can useful, which say in many ways we've kind of forgotten how to study history. And I take the approach that the way you study history is to, first of all, you have an obligation to try to understand them as they understood themselves. What were they dealing with? What were the influences? What were they trying to accomplish? America is not perfect. I don't make that claim at all. That's because we're imperfect people. We're fallen, but also politics and life is difficult. Okay, but how are you going to understand it? What were their aspirations? What were they trying to accomplish? And I think if you can draw people into that, change their way of looking at it and draw them in, are they going to agree on everything? No, not necessarily, but you've drawn them into the narrative, into the story. And once you're into the story, and if you take it seriously and read it and read what they wrote and what they said and what they debated, it's a really interesting story. The history is really interesting and fun and dynamic, and you really get into it. But then once you realize in the middle of all that, that ongoing debates, and I mean, British ships are arriving at the same moment that the Declaration is being written. It's just amazing. And yet in that very moment, they had the mind to slowly spend 2 days carefully editing this document, which they knew would be a permanent statement of principle.
And they made it better. Jefferson gets the credit.
Made it better.
But they saved Jefferson some parts that needed, I mean, he later kind of later in life complained about
it. He didn't like it, but no. There were definitely some parts that needed editing. There's some parts that needed to be cut out. And it's, if you look at, some of the great historians that have written about on the creation of the Declaration, they're all in agreement. This is an extremely rare but successful example of group editing. And it was a fabulous, fabulous job. It really was providential in that sense. Mm-hmm. But in the middle of all these things going on around, I mean, this is a very small country with almost no army for all intents and purposes, literally about to go to war with the greatest military power in the world. And yet they didn't need to write this declaration. It wasn't necessary. They passed the Declaration, or they passed independence on July 2nd. They didn't need a declaration written by Jefferson, right? It was, but they chose to do that. We want a statement. We want to put it down on paper. We want to say what we believe. And that then makes it remarkable, because it's very much unlike the normal European or historical documents that merely state what they're doing.
Right.
No, this is clearly a philosophical grounding. In that sense, it's radical, in the sense of getting back to the root.
The root. And they understood from the beginning. I mean, they didn't know what America could become, but they did understand. Not only are they speaking, yes, they're speaking to France, they're speaking to Britain, obviously, they're speaking to an international community, but that doesn't do it justice if you think they're just doing a bit of international negotiation. I mean, read some people say, well, they're putting in these things about God because they want the French to come on their side. No. They understand there's something potentially really significant in what they're doing. And one of the arguments I've seen even presently is, well, we're doing too much to this kind of founderism, and this is a very new phenomenon to look at the founders. I mean, you're more of an expert than I am, but you know, the what is it, 9 volumes that Sanderson put out, the biographies of the lives of the signers already in the 1820s and 30s. Right. I mean, from the very beginning, they're seeing that these 56 men who signed this have done something of historic consequence,
right,
and
right.
Already Americans are looking to them. I mean, I've read sermons from Presbyterians at, you know, the 10, 15, 20 year anniversary of the Declaration, and some of them at the Constitution. And they're already, I mean, some of it gets to be hagiography, but they're already celebrating this generation. So our fascination with the founders is not something that we just decided to do after World War II or World War I. It's really been there from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
No. It does ebbs and flows. And I agree with you. Sometimes you have to look at it with a little, you know, there's some hagiography here and there, and it's overstated. That's all.
George Washington looks like, you know, he's a god. And
this really gets back to the founders themselves. They clearly had a sense about them, mm-hmm. that they're breaking away from England. They're on this eastern seaboard by themselves. Something great is happening here, because when they're breaking with England, they're also automatically talking about a new country. And because of their being separated from England, because of their religious influences, because of all the things that shaped them, they very naturally start thinking about compacts and agreements of larger moral meaning. And if you read, it's especially clear, say, in something like the Federalist Papers, but in their earlier writings as well, they're thinking that their model here is not merely some other country that evolves out of the forest of Germany or something. What are they thinking about? They're thinking about Rome. They're thinking about Athens. They're thinking about these great civilizations that are founded by lawgivers. And so they had that sense about them, which of course calls upon our judgment. Were they right? Mm-hmm. Maybe they were wrong about all this. Maybe this is a problem. But there is something very natural about our political tradition, our history, but our political tradition that always points backwards, which is not to say we look backwards, but there's something about our beginnings that is crucial. I mean, the other great thing, of course, that does that, that really causes that to be the case, is our legal system. That is the European legal systems really are more on an evolutionary model. Like, you have a law, the next law replaces that, and it merely goes forward. Whereas the American legal system is it has changes and amendments and blah, 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 but it always points back to the beginning. It's the Constitution, which is the founding constitutional document. And countries that have constitutions naturally do that. Ours does it perhaps more profound than others. But then the other point is that historically, and also merely as a legal matter, remember, The Declaration of Independence is an organic document in the United States Code. It is actually a legal document. It is a piece of legislation passed by the Continental Congress. It's not merely some thing that Jefferson wrote up on the weekend, right? Which means if our legal system points back to the Constitution, that necessarily means it also points to the Declaration, which is the document that explains the Constitution. So, yeah, this is why, look, our politics is always turned upon who are we?
Right.
What is our purpose? What are we doing in the world? Consent, all these questions. These are declaration questions.
And I think you can make the argument that even the way we conceive of that shows its origin in Protestant Christianity, by which I mean that Protestants, and there was one Catholic who signed the Declaration, but that Protestantism looks at, believes in a text, a book that you interpret, that you keep coming back to. And it's not that Roger Sherman or John Witherspoon or Sam Adams thought these were inspired as scripture. But as you said from the beginning, it was, there's things written down that point to eternal things, to first principles, and we ought to interpret them. They have a meaning. We can discern the meaning, and we ought to be constantly checking back on how we are doing compared to these first things. I think there is something to that Protestant impulse on how a people understand their identity and what is the norming norm for their raison d'etre, right, and their teleology.
Well said. I completely agree, which is what I made my allusion early to compact. Think of the Mayflower Compact. I mean, the early Christian sense of to begin something, you have to make a compact. And that compact is among us, but before God. There's a very strong sense of that. And if you look at the Declaration in that sense, the Declaration lays out this whole argument. And what does it end with? It ends with them taking a pledge to each other in light of God, in the face of divine providence. I mean, we look to the Supreme Judge for the rectitude of our intention. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not specifically doctrinal. It's not necessarily as detailed as perhaps some might want, but let's not miss the forest for the trees. There's clearly a powerful theology in the Declaration, which then, if you understand properly the relation of Declaration and the Constitution, this gets into, you know, a little more difficult as to how we relate them and its legal standing and that kind of thing, right? The Constitution is a framework of law. But that would lead me to conclude, which I think is a much more powerful argument about our laws today, is that the Constitution is also not meant to be a completely secularizing document. It was not intended to be a specifically Christian document, although it does refer to the year of our Lord. Mm-hmm. But it's understood, its theology is the theology of the Declaration, which is human equality under the laws of nature and nature's God, which is the natural law tradition. And I understand nature's God to be, that's often seen as kind of being a deistic argument, but it actually comes from Alexander Pope and is a reference actually to the biblical idea of moving from nature to nature's God. You're rising up to nature's God.
You make the point. Those are not, we shouldn't read those as identical phrases. They're saying two related but separate things with nature and nature's God.
Well, it's a strange phrase in the sense that it's the laws of nature and of nature's God, mm-hmm. which is there's one set of laws, but there are two ways to understand them. One way is to the laws of nature, which is the general natural law tradition, going back to the Christian tradition, but also back to the Romans and the Greeks. It's a rational tradition. But the laws of nature's God implies that those same laws are also the laws created by the God who creates nature. And that starts you down that path, which say that you can also look at the laws of nature, natural law, to be what we might call general revelation, mm-hmm. not specific revelation, but general revelation, which is that revelation that we is kind of in our hearts and understood through our, that we can come to understand ourselves without direct revelation.
And that was so helpful how you delineated that in your book and commentary. I want to make sure we get you know, some of the most famous lines here, and we can't get everything that you write, but let's go to the second paragraph. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Let's just do a little bit line by line. So we hold these truths to be self-evident. Someone could say, hey, look, there's all sorts of countries around the world. These things, they didn't come to this conclusion. How self-evident? And yet there's a philosophy behind this. What did they mean by saying we hold? Notice they didn't say it's obvious to everyone.
Right.
They said, no, we hold them to be self-evident. Unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. No, important to unpack that. We hold these truths to be self-evident, which is either there are certain truths which are so powerful, they are self-evident. It doesn't mean obvious. But it's also not merely, is in that natural law tradition, mm-hmm. this idea of self-evidence. The famous reference to and use of self-evidence actually comes from Aquinas, but you can track it back to Aristotle and Greek mathematics and logic. But also you see it in legal reasoning. Per se is per se notum, which is there are certain things that can be known. It's if you understand the terms of the thing, you understand the thing. So, for instance, Aquinas's example is if you understand man, you understand that man is rational because that's by nature what man is. And if you think of rational, you think man. It's just it's
right.
They're so interconnected that you understand them that way. So. But to come back to our general point about this theological point, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Okay. And the first one is that all men are created equal. So we can talk about the general notion of equality, what they meant by equality, which I would argue is this general sense that we are equally human, right? I mean,
as you point out, someone could say, equal? What do you mean? We're born with different gifts. We're born with different status. Right. We're unequal in every way. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. They meant we were equally human in the sense that no one is born booted and spurred. No one is born with a saddle on their backs, which is why ultimately the principle of equality is what undermines slavery. But here's a twist, which is kind of hard to fathom here. They're saying here we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. How is it self-evident that we are created equal? See, this is where you really can't extract from that document. You can't escape. You can't take away from it. It's these deep theological roots. They say that there's...
It gives an anthropology. At the very beginning, you are a created being. That's a big first principle.
No, it's massive. It's huge. And not only are you created equal, but you're endowed by your creator with these rights, which say that rights don't come from government. They don't come from the Supreme Court. They don't come from merely the tradition over time. And we've developed them slowly evolving for thousands of years. No. You're endowed. It's a gift of the same creator God. I mean, that's the magnitude of that is just shockingly radical.
And then walk us through life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, especially, the pursuit of happiness, which is the one that quickly gets misappropriated. And you do a nice job in the book of showing, in some ways, it's the richest philosophical phrase of the three.
It always threw me because the word happiness. Is very important in Greek philosophy, Plato, Aristotle, the Roman tradition, Cicero, and even before you get to the Christian tradition, happiness has always been the end. Now, Christianity, of course, expands that end to a higher form of happiness. But having said that, happiness was always understood to be this larger end having to do with self, human fulfillment. And it was never understood to be whatever makes you feel good. Now, Jefferson actually proposes life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They don't say life, liberty, and property, which is the Lockean formulation.
Right. I was going to ask why they didn't do the Lockean formulation.
And but that the pursuit of happiness formulation was never questioned. Never. No one thought twice about that. And yet I find it unfathomable that Jefferson and all the other founders, who themselves had studied, especially Roman and Cicero and that thinking, and they're very much shaped by the Christian tradition, that they would not think that happiness had substantive meaning is unfathomable. So the notion that we have today that the pursuit of happiness means whatever makes you feel good, I think that's just a complete absurdity from the founders' point of view. They write at great length what the difference between liberty and licentiousness. That's just not in their worldview, if you will. So then the question is, you have these three phrases: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Why those three? And my argument is that they chose those three not to exclude anything else. So, for instance, a right to property or a right to bear arms or a right to religious liberty are not there. They chose those three because they really pull together all the aspects of human life. Life itself, right? The very being of life, the thing which we have, the thing which we are created, right? Life, liberty, what man does as a normal thing, right? We are rational, thoughtful, deliberative, make decisions, we do things. But what do we move toward? That's where the pursuit of happiness becomes the key piece. The pursuit of happiness. The reason religious liberty is always understood to be in there is because ultimately, if you think of happiness as a fulfillment of man's ends, what is his highest fulfillment is the openness in the American experiment from a political point of view, and from a Christian point of view, the attraction, if you will, to even go beyond that, to know God. That essentially is the argument for religious liberty. And that's what the pursuit of happiness was meant to leave open. It didn't mean just anything and everything. It was more kind of that eudaimonic sense of you get in the Greeks of human fulfillment in a substantive way.
And you really underscored too, don't miss the word, the pursuit. It does not guarantee, the government can't guarantee everyone's happy.
Right.
It's also different than the government's role is to necessarily produce in you the greatest heavenly good. What it does, their vision is it protects the inalienable right given by God for your life, your liberty, and that you can pursue it. Sadly, many people pursue it to the wrong end. And if that end interferes with other people's God-given rights, then we have laws to counteract that. But the founders, I think, had enough of, let's call it Calvinist, Augustinian anthropology to know what government could and could not do. And it can allow you to pursue, but it doesn't have the wherewithal to necessarily determine what that final best end is for you. Not that some people signing the Declaration didn't know. Most of them, you know, were Christians of one kind or another. But I think just the word, the pursuit of happiness, rather than, I think many people today think, I have a right
to happiness.
I have a right to happiness.
Right.
Is government providing me all the things to be happy?
I think that's absolutely right. And actually, one of the people, I've always noticed that, but one of the things that especially encouraged me on this point is the last essay C.S. Lewis wrote in his life was about this particular point, which is it's right to pursue happiness, not to have happiness. And you're absolutely right in the sense that there's an understanding that somehow we're kind of diminishing the role of government. Government is no longer in the job of determining your happiness, but government is now have taken on the responsibility to guarantee your ability mm-hmm. to pursue it. But the crucial thing there is there are some parameters,
right?
Which is say that, if you're pursuing of happiness means I like to eat small children, there are limits to that, which is there's this general sense. There's kind of a nature of things that you can't violate, right? If your happiness demands the denial of gravity, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and it relates.
Are there debates, and is that difficult? Yes. That is all true, but it's absolutely clear in my mind that the founders never intended, and really you can't find anywhere where they say this at all. They never meant the pursuit of happiness to be just a catch-all, just more liberty, whatever right. you want. Everything's free. There's no evidence that they meant that. Here we are in modern culture, so far along this path, so far down these various ways. I think that the founders would not really understand how we would make that kind of liberty argument.
Yeah, in a subsequent chapter, of course, the classical tradition with the four virtues, and you highlight the role that prudence plays. Now, fortitude matters, temperance matters, justice matters, but just talk about the role that prudence plays in their thinking about what they're doing in impelling this separation and starting this new country. Why prudence?
You're absolutely right in pointing that out, but also I emphasize it very strongly because how important it is. Look, first of all, just as a matter of the movement of the Declaration, all the truths are self-evident, and at the end of the document, they make their decisions about independence. But in the middle, there's this long argument before they get to the grievances, which are also very important, mm-hmm. In which they say prudence will dictate. And that's actually the most classical word in the whole document. Prudence is one of the four cardinal virtues, and it was always understood to be the cardinal virtue when it comes to politics. By which I don't just mean politics in the sense that we might think of it naturally as political affairs.
The polis,
but also in terms of just human activity. Mm-hmm. Courage, all the other virtues, the moral virtues require prudence, right? What is courage is always determined by the circumstances. What do you do under this particular circumstance? So the fact that they turn to prudence as a crucial piece signals to me the extent to which they are thinking of and acting and following the thinking of that whole tradition, the classical and the Christian tradition. Because prudence is really the cardinal virtue in both the classical and the Christian tradition.
Yeah, Aquinas writes extensively.
And so that tells me again, this is not merely some knockoff modern document that's going off into some new direction. They're saying, here are the principles that we hold to be self-evident. Boom, 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 boom. Prudence is going to determine how we proceed, which say we're going to proceed based on the classical traditional notion of how we think through the relationship between principles and practice. And then they have a long section on grievances, which I spend a lot of time in my book trying mm-hmm. to figure out what all that means. And then they come to their conclusion, which is to say the Declaration is a highly deliberative, serious, thoughtful document that, it is revolutionary in the narrow mm-hmm. sense, but it's not revolutionary in the, say, the French Revolution sense that it's all about merely throwing things off and blowing things up and turning things over. They are revolutionary in the sense of, or I've used earlier the word radical, and radical means going to the root of something. They're actually going back to and recovering a much older way of thinking, in my opinion, looking back to this natural law tradition, an understanding of human equality grounded in that tradition, but also very much shaped by Christianity. And how do we bring that about in this world? And they're still doing it through the modicum, the process, if you will, of this cardinal virtue, prudence, which is probably centrally important.
It's very well put. We're coming up on an hour. You've referenced the closing line a few times, but you state rightly how eloquent it is. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Those words are so familiar, I hope they're familiar to Americans, that we can forget they didn't just drop out of the sky. They thought about what they wanted to right. say there, that they rely on divine providence, that they refer to their sacred honor, talk about how more than just being a beautiful ending to the Declaration, there's actually really important truths reinforced in this last paragraph.
It is the most beautiful line, in my opinion, and the opinion of many as well. It's just a wonderful use of wording. What I was most struck by when I started going through this work is that that last paragraph ends, right? We the representatives of the American people, we are and ought to be independent and have the rights of any other country. Mm-hmm. And then there's this last line. Well, that last line technically serves no purpose. It just kind of hangs there and begs the question, why is it there? Because they've already declared an independence. But the document ends then with they pledge to each other. It's kind of an awkward phrasing, if you will. Pledge to each other, mutually pledge to each other. It's right, kind of like doubling down on it. It's an oath, and it's an oath to pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. It becomes an oath because it's in light of the divine providence. But it's also intended to be, and Jefferson, master of words, it's clearly a changing around of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. And so now we're pledging to each other our lives. Okay, that, I understand that, which was literally a lives. This is a war. We're going to war here. I pledge to you my life in this cause. But not just liberty, my life, our fortunes, which say that my wealth, but also my family name, my reputation, my future, my children's future, right? I'm pledging that to you as well. But I can't pledge to you my happiness. It's just, right? I can't pledge to you something I am trying to attain, but right. I can pledge to you my honor. And it's not just honor, right? The hard word there, the word that really makes it ring. Our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Not just honor, which is an old classical word of great excellence, but it's an honor that's an honorable before God. It's honor to the point that it is sacred. So it's a very powerful ending. Mm-hmm. And all the stories when you read about this document being read aloud historically in different audiences and whatnot, that closing really is a ringing closing. Hat tip to Jefferson. Those were his words, unedited. He's got a very keen, sense of the words. Beautiful, beautiful line. But again, it's part of this larger. You can never escape this deeper theological meaning of the document. And it's just it's there for anybody that'll see it, which is what led me to conclude that. Yes, you draw in, it's the story, it's this great document, we've all read it a million times before, but you started going through it seriously and seeing what they said and how they said it and how they edited it and what the words then actually mean and the historical references to other documents and whatnot, you can't fail to see what it is. And my hope is that as we do that in this anniversary year, we will be learning our history, but more importantly, we will be rediscovering those truths, which is what we need more than anything, now in our current cultural divide. And I think Declaration does that very much so.
No, and your book really walks us through. I was just going to ask, if you got one more minute, though it's not a minute question, briefly, to last question, to circle back where we started, how would you answer the question then, is the Declaration of Independence a Christian document, and did it found a Christian nation?
That's always the hard question, right? I mean, I think I would probably say, here I want to be careful with my words, and I haven't completely thought this through exactly, but I would say yes and no, which say that I would push back against the particular, this notion of a Christian, specifically Christian nation. And I think in many ways, that's the wrong way to ask the question, because it in many ways puts too much onus on us, right? Because we're trying to somehow turn America into something that it really isn't. But at the same time, I think that We were wanting to go, and I understand the argument about wanting to have more depth there. We still have and can really point to very deep and profound Christian influences, which are not merely kind of cultural, historical influences, but really kind of come into our documents and come into our particulars of the nation. So I would probably say it's a America is deeply Christian in how it was formed, partially because I think the West, Western civilization, is deeply Christian in how it was came to be. You can't have it without that.
Yeah.
But I would, our whole conversation really goes towards trying to define that ground, if you will, by which we can create that ground upon which to build a nation. But I think sometimes we might overstate that when we say specifically it's a Christian nation in some formal sense.
Right.
I think it's hard to prove. The history isn't really there. But also we kind of get out on a limb, so to speak. And as a result, because we can't fully make that argument, we miss and give up on what actually is there, which was a deeply, deeply theological moral argument grounded in the Christian tradition and the natural law tradition, to which we ought to be turning today to recover that. And if we overstate it somehow, I think our strongest arguments tend to get neglected. And so part of my argument is that we want to go back to to some extent, wanting to talk about the Christian nation is in many ways admitting the more kind of modern progressive interpretation of the founding, which was, oh, it was really kind of deistic. So therefore, we have to overstate it to fight back. I understand the inclination, but I guess my argument is that, no, there's actually a lot there we shouldn't give up on without having to go there, because when you introduce sort of the formality of a Christian nation, there are other problems that come along with that, which I think is not where we want to be going.
Yeah, no, that's very well said. And there's plenty of other ways to put it. You said the document doesn't make sense apart from Christianity, or the founding of the nation is dependent upon Christianity, or it's a flower from, I mean, there's lots of ways to rightly, with lots of hard evidence, point to the essential role of Christianity at the founding without making, and I think a lot of well-meaning people just out there, listen, that's what they want to say. And one of the things I love about your book, you're giving us some better categories, more textual, more historical. So I'm not just saying this, I really do encourage all the listeners, viewers, Matthew Spaulding's new book, there's lots of things you should read for 2026 if you're an American. And this is one right at the top of the list, The Making of the American Mind, The Story of Our Declaration of Independence. So, Matthew, thank you so much for taking time.
Evan, it's been great being with you. Great conversation. Love this conversation. Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm glad you're going to have some say, you and Bill McClay, on the 250th anniversary, and look forward to celebrating and learning in the months ahead.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to all of our listeners. This is Life in Books and Everything, a ministry of Clearly Reformed. You can find lots of other episodes and resources on our website. Until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.
Amen.